London.
Mr. Chief Justice, Your Highness, General Griswold, Mr. Pickle, I think it might be helpful if I address my attention to the facts which lie behind these cases, or this case, the Washington Post case, as it comes before Your Honors, because I think we have heard here a familiar plea, familiar to us who have been involved in this case over this last intense week, that some more time is needed while the First Amendment is suspended. We first faced this question, Judge Cassell did, some week ago, and after a hearing on the temporary restraining order, unconvinced by the generality and lack of specificity, he denied the temporary restraining order. The government, as of course was its right, promptly went up to the Court of Appeals, and in an extraordinary late session, everything's been late, I may say, in this case, late hours anyways, the Court of Appeals, 2-1, Judges Robb and Judge Robinson granted a temporary restraining order to the government to give them some time, and thus, for the second time in 2 weeks, and the second time in 200 years, the United States succeeded in obtaining a prior restraint against the press. Now, the Court of Appeals stated, in its order that it would send it to the district court, and the district court would try it to determine whether the granting of an injunction, whether the publication of material, would so prejudice the defense interests of the United States or result in such irreparable injury to the United States as to justify the extraordinary relief that was asked to it, a prior restraint.
Before you proceed, Mr. Glendon, do you agree that that is the proper test?
I think that's the proper test, Your Honor. Yes, that's the test that we tried the case under, and I think the implications of the words may require some development, and I'm sure there will be arguments as to exactly what those words mean, but that's the test we tried the case.
And then would you repeat the words so that I'll have them in mind?
So prejudice. The defense interests of the United States are resulting in such irreparable injury to the United States as would justify restraining the publication.
Then that would not cover the simple death, say, of 100 or 200 young men.
Well, Your Honor, that's a hard case you put in ours. I think we all have to measure this case in the light of what we have before us and what we know we have before us.
Well, we have a lot of things under seal
I'm going to address myself to those, Your Honor, and I'm going to point out as best I can within the limits here, and as did other courts, and the government has not yet brought anything like that case to Your Honor. Nothing like it. And what we have heard, Your Honor, is much more in the nature of conjecture and surmise.
Can anyone know in any certain sense the consequences of the disclosure of sources of information, for example, the upsetting of negotiations, if that were hypothetically true in Paris, or possible negotiations that we don't know anything about for the release of war prisoners, that sort of thing? How does a government meet the burden of proof in the sense that Judge Cassell laid it down? That doesn't bring any battleships to the outer limits of New York Harbor or set off any missiles, but would you say that it's not a very grave matter?
I think if we are to place possibilities or conjecture against suspension or abridgment of the First Amendment, the answer is obvious. The fact, the possibility, the conjecture, or the hypothesis that diplomatic negotiations would be made more difficult or embarrassed does not justify, and this is what we have in this case, I think, it's all we have, does not justify suspending the First Amendment, yet this is what's happened here. Conjecture can be piled upon surmise. Judge Gerfein used the word up in New York, and I'm sure he used it respectfully, but he said when there is a security breach, people get the jitters. And I think there's maybe the government has a case of the jitters here, but that, I submit, does not warrant the stopping the press on this matter in the absence of a showing. And I'd like to turn to that, because this matter, as I don't have to say, does not come undeveloped before your honors. Two fine district court judges, two fine courts of appeals have considered this. And in each, I think it's fair to say, even in the New York case, the government did not meet its burden. And so it says to us, but one more time, just one more time. And this is where I was a moment ago when I said that Judge Robb and Judge Robinson agreed to give them a chance. Now, we had a hearing in the District of Columbia, and I'd like to, if I may, comment upon what the government said, and it said it twice about that hearing, because really, your honors are being asked to, on a representation, and it's a sincere representation by General Griswold, but on a representation, if we're given some more time, maybe we can find something. But here's what the government says in its brief, and it said it again yesterday. They said, in New York, the government was not able to present to the court all of the evidence relating to the impact of the disclosure of this material upon foreign relations and national defense that it was able to present to the district court in the Washington Post case. We had, and the government was accorded, the fullest hearing that it wanted. We started at the unusual 8 o'clock in the morning. The government's case proceeded through the luncheon hour. We cross-examined as we felt was necessary. The court had plenty of time to consider the matter. He delivered, I think you agree, whether you agree with his result, a finely reasoned opinion. So there was no rush and no pressure. Then the matter went up to the Court of Appeals, and there the Court of Appeals had a session of some 3 hours the next day. And I might say, too, and I think this is perhaps important, there's been no restriction on the government's latitude, because they did have these in-camera hearings, which, frankly, were very difficult from our point of view to deal with. But they did have them, and they had an in-camera hearing in the Court of Appeals. So to say now that we need more time, I think, does not measure up to the other side of the equation, which you're being asked to do, and that is to restrain two newspapers while others are publishing from giving their readers the news. And it is, of course, their readers that we feel, and I think probably, rights are involved too, their right to know. And I'm talking about currency and immediacy. There is now involved in this country, the country is engaged in an intense national debate. Things are happening this week on that score. This lawsuit, these lawsuits undoubtedly precipitated the executive to turn over these documents to the Congress. Now, Senator Fulbright, as I'm sure you're all aware, has been trying for some 2 years, I understand, to get these documents. And I think it's of interest here because we're dealing with this case and these documents. And I think classification is important here in your consideration of these cases, because these documents were classified top secret. Now, they were classified top secret because some unknown individual who was not presented to the court, whose subjective judgment couldn't be explored, despite the district judge asking that he be brought in, perhaps it was a good reason, we don't know, decided that they were top secret. They were all top secret because one was top secret. There had been no review of these documents, except for one individual who said that he had been reviewing them for some 2 years for sensitivity. And the sensitivity arose from Senator Fulbright's frequent request to get these documents so the Congress could make the laws and perhaps the public could be informed.
Does the record show how long the Post has had these documents in its possession?
How long it has had them in its possession, it does not show, Your Honor.
Does it show, if you know, how long the New York Times have the documents in their possession before the Post got them?
The record in our case does not show that, Your Honor, but I have read, and perhaps these gentlemen, Mr. Beckwith can answer better, I understood they had them in their possession for some months.
I a month or two. Somewhere, 3 to 4 months.
Yes. It is not in the record, but that's my best answer to that. Now, after this proceeding was brought, and I think it again is part of the significance of this proceeding, and during the course of it, although starting out at the point that these documents were top secret and none could be disclosed, the government has offered to review them, and perhaps some of them, they say, will be declassified, which I suppose is some sort of admission that the original classification and the original attitude towards them was wrong.
Of course, it could be that something classified in 1965 properly would be no longer subject to classification, or even 69 or 70. Is that true?
That is correct, Your Honor. And furthermore, some of these documents were classified, go back, of course, to 1945. The documents are that ancient. The document itself is entitled a history. It's called a history, and from what I've seen of it, that's what it is. Now, the court, in our case, had before it, and Your Honors will see the evidence, of which I'm aware there apparently has been, there has been today additional references made to the documents, but it is a fact, and I think it's a significant fact, that the judge there asked the government to show him a document. Now, these extravagant claims were made, and I say this respectfully, but this has been a case of broad claims and narrow proof. Substantial claims have been made, and if you accept them, they would be worried. But we're talking here about proof.
Well, and was there an order at any time to produce all the documents in the possession of either of the newspapers for examination?
The government, there was not, Your Honor.
Was there a request for such an order?
The government made such a request, and because of the concern that the newspaper has as to protection of its source, the documents we were advised would indicate the source.
What do you mean the court?
The documents that we had would indicate the source.
Who denied that request? The district judge?
Yes, and here's how he resolved
it. He let that override the federal rules of civil procedure on discovery?
Here's how he resolved it, man. I think he did it very fairly, Your Honor. He said, if you are not willing to produce the documents, we do not have all the documents, but if you will not produce all the documents because of your claim of First Amendment source protection, then I will assume that you have all the documents, and therefore the government can show me any document. Show me any document, and I will accept that as being in your possession for the purposes of the case. And I think that was a very, very, under circumstances, a very fair way to do it. I no more than any other lawyer, like to be in that position, but I have to respect my client's assertion, which is a substantial and I think a valid assertion, that a newspaper is entitled to protect its source. And so that's the way it was, you know.
Mr. Glenn and I recall an ancient doctrine of equity that about people who come into equity, certain burdens on them. And doesn't it strike you as rather extraordinary that in a case which largely centers on protection of sources, the newspapers are refusing to reveal documents on the grounds that they must refuse in order to protect their sources?
You know, I don't understand that is the issue here.
I don't know the issue. It's in this case. This is only a proceeding, and there are certain standards about people coming into equity, coming in with clean hands is one of them.
Well, of course, we're
there to do equity.
We did not come into equity. The government came into equity, but I don't.
You were brought in.
We were brought in kicking and screaming, I guess.
You're now in the position of making demands on the First Amendment
That's right.
And you say the newspaper has a right to protect its sources.
I see no.
The government does not.
I see no conflict, Your Honor. I see no conflict at all. We're in the position of asking that there not be a prior restraint in violation of the Constitution imposed on us, and that equity should not do that. We are also in the position of saying that under the First Amendment, we are entitled to protect our sources, and I just don't find any conflict there, Your Honor. The record shows, and I think this is important in Your Honor's consideration too, we are, as I said, talking about allegedly top secret documents. And the record shows that these nomers are of secret and top secret are ordered perhaps in the breach in Washington, and the way the government does business and the way it has perhaps to do business. But it is certainly true there is massive overclassification of documents in Washington. We have in the record instances where one government official or another has quite clearly indicated that while everything on his desk may be classified in one fashion or another, in fact, perhaps 1%, 2%, 5% of it really is classified. And I think that's a realistic fact of life here. We also have clearly in the record that the government and the press, who have some mutual, perhaps antagonism isn't quite the word, but they are naturally in opposite corners. The press is trying to get as much news as it can. The government, particularly where it may be embarrassing or where it may be overly concerned or may feel it's embarrassing or may, in Judge Gerfein's words, have the jitters, is trying to prevent that sometimes. On other occasions, the government engages itself in leaks because some official will feel that in the public interest, it's well for the public to know, and that overrides any particular judgment about security or classification. And the record, Your Honors, will find is replete with instances where leaks of confidential, secret, top secret material have been given to the press, or the press has found them out and published them, and of course nothing has happened. Now, I think that's a significant because here, this is the sort of thing we feel we're talking about. As far as classification itself is concerned, you will remember that the documents that we're talking about are a mixed bag. They have...
Mr. Clinton, wouldn't you be making the same argument if your client had stolen these papers?
I don't think that the source, I don't think the how we acquired them, Your Honor, features in this case.
Well, then it wouldn't make any difference. The leak aspect has no relevance to the case either, then.
I think it's relevant as background because this is not, this is the way that...
Well, then it would be relevant if you stole them.
I think so.
And you'd be making the same argument that your client sent an agent into the government and stole these papers, and then the government attempted to restrain your publication of them.
I just don't think that the... I don't think that the manner in which...
Well, then one is irrelevant to the other.
Well, Your Honor, I think if you examine that's certainly not true. It's certainly not customary. The size here is different, but I think that you will find, Your Honor, in the affidavits that we have attached to, and the exhibits that we have attached to our affidavits, indicating secret stories, allegedly secret, based on secret information, and there's probably more secret information there than you'll find in these documents if you examine them.
What basis did it have on this case?
I think it's simply a matter of background, Your Honor, and atmosphere to show that this is not an untoward or unknown situation. And when we hear about how our foreign allies or our foreign friends will be shocked or appalled or anything else, it's simply not so. This happens. It's one of the facts of life. I was starting to advert to the district judge telling the government to show it, which is what he was supposed to do. That's what the Court of Appeals sent it back for. And he requested to show these documents, these top secret documents. They were in the courtroom, and the government was invited, and it has been invited, to show, let's look at what we're talking about instead of dealing just with abstractions and conjectures. Now, This was on the so-called secret transcript, and I'm not going to revert to it, other than to say that the one document that the government produced in response to this invitation was set forth certain options with reference to the war, and I won't go any further than that, which I think any high school boy would have no difficulty in either putting together himself or readily understanding. All of them are in the public press. Now, this is the sort of proof we've been faced with, and this is the will of the wisp that we've been chasing.
Well, Mr. Glendon, then I come back to you with the same inquiry I made at Professor Fickle. At least it was close enough to persuade one judge of the Court of Appeals to disagree with what you've just said.
Well, Your Honor, that is true. I'd like to revert to the fact that the other members of the Court of Appeals felt constrained after they read that particular dissent to just yesterday issue an amendment to their opinion in which they reiterated that they disagreed with Judge McKinnon, which to me was some indication of the strength and depth of their feeling. But Your Honor is right. Judge Wilkie felt, and I say to Your Honor that, I say respectfully, is not based on the record. There's nothing in the record that I know of that would, and I think I know the record as far as it's been disclosed to me. There's some perhaps new material this morning. It's not. But as far as the record's been disclosed to me, there's absolutely nothing to justify that statement, and as I say, the Court of Appeals felt strong enough about it to issue another statement, to issue an amendment in which they specifically said they disagree.
The issues in this case really are factual issues, aren't they?
Well,
I mean, as I understand it, and this is my understanding initially, I haven't heard anything really to...
Lastly, yes.
On my understanding, you agree that an injunction could issue, despite the First Amendment, if it were shown, proved by the government, that there was something here, disclosure of which would directly cause a grave, irreparable, and immediate danger to the country. You agree that an injunction could issue. You just simply say they've shown nothing of the kind. Isn't that right?
They have shown nothing of that kind or by any other measurable standard that I understand could possibly be involved in this case, whether you take the top secret.
So it's a matter of fact.
Top secret definitions or anything else. Yeah, but there is something behind this, too, which I think perhaps is a legal issue, and that's the scope of the review here.
Scope of the review of what?
Review of the findings of the district.
Findings of fact under Rule 52A,
yeah.
Isn't it?
That's right. Now,
these are factual issues.
Yeah. And there is one legal question perhaps I'll come to later, and that is the futility of an injunction here, but I don't want to...
I think that you do assert that there is not a single document in the 47 documents which is now entitled to the top secret classification as defined in the executive order.
No, sir. I assert this, Your Honor, and I'm involved in a law. Any other standard I'm talking about. I think that the standard is reasonably clear here, but whether you use words such as gravely prejudice the United States or irreparably injure the defense of the United States, whatever the standard may be. Anything the government has brought forward. Well, Your Honor, the government came into court. They suspended the First Amendment. They stopped us from printing. And they said they were going to prove this. And this is an injunction proceeding. Now, it may be that the government would feel that the courts should become the Defense Department's security officer. And the court should delve into this pile of paper, 47 volumes, and on its own, from time to time, whenever they're so moved, the government is so moved that the court should look for them. I say, Your Honor, in our system, as I understand it, when you bring a case, you're supposed to prove it. And when you come in claiming irreparable injury, particularly in this area of the First Amendment, you have a very, very heavy burden.
Do you agree that Judge Gazelle applied to the top secret definition that is given? his guy?
Yes, I think that would appear from his opinion. He looked at it that way from his opinion, yes, Your Honor. As far as I can determine from... Yes, I think that fits in clearly to what we're talking about under the doctrine of Neer v. Minnesota, yes, sir.
If the trial judge used a clearly erroneous standard, then the case is not simply controlled by facts, is it?
Your Honor, I'm sorry,
if a trial judge in these circumstances used a standard to judge the facts, and the standard was clearly erroneous, then this is not just a fact case, is it?
Well, I think that the clearly erroneous rule would apply to the facts, what facts he found, and in that point, Your Honor.
But if he used the wrong standard, then it ceases to be just a fact case.
Well, I feel that he used the right standard. Your Honor will determine that here, and I think that as far as the law is concerned, that is substantially the standard. Whether you can perhaps use alternative words, but the thing is, I think, is immediacy and currency, current injury to the United States, as this court has been so substantial that it justifies what's been done here. I mean, it isn't just that the United States has been injured. Judge Cassell made a point, which I think is a very good one, and I think perhaps the government may forget that the interest of the United States is the people's interest. And you're weighing here, and this is why I suppose we're here, but you're weighing here an abridgment of the First Amendment, the people's right to know. And that may be an abstraction, but it's one that's kept this country and made it great for some 200 years, and you're being asked to approve something that the government has never done before. We were told by the Attorney General to stop publishing this news. We didn't obey that order, and we were brought into court, and we ended up being enjoined. And I do think that when you come to that balance in face of the proof that exists here, that the decision is quite clear that the First Amendment must survive because they haven't made out a case. I think essentially they did, Justice Howland.
They didn't find it a matter of review, did they? They considered it a matter of original findings.
Yeah.
They weren't reviewing any classification.
They weren't reviewing. They were making an original determination. It wasn't, under the circumstances and the proof before them, there was not the kind of injury, the irreparable injury.
There was no law hearing on whether or not the publication would...
Sure, it was a total hearing.
It wasn't reviewing any classification by the Executive Department, was it? They didn't consider that that's what they were doing.
No, it featured in the evidence, Your Honor, as to how the classification got put on there, because that, of course, is the bedrock of
the irrelevant, isn't it?
No, because the government says, and you must listen, they say, it's top secret, and that's it.
No, I haven't heard the Solicitor General say that here today at all.
Well, that's my understanding of the whole
thing. I asked him that question. He said there were those in the government who would like to make that argument, but he was not pressing it.
Well, it's the argument we've heard along that, and you see that having classified a top secret, they move from there to show no proof.
No, it hasn't. The government has not in this court made the argument that simply because it's top secret, they're entitled to an injunction. They have not made that argument.
I was trying to say that having classified the documents top secret, that's the premise of their case. They have not yet come into this court and proven they're top secret. And yet they say we can't publish them because they are top secret, as I understand.
May I say that I understand the argument from both the lawyers for the New York Times. It seems to me that they have pursued it, they have argued it on the premise that the First Amendment freedom of speech can be abridged by Congress if it desires to do so.
I did not make that argument.
I understood you to. I did not understand you to make any other argument, or your colleague.
No, I did not.
You talk about standards. I'm not talking about standards. First Amendment says that Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of the press.
That's
I understand you to say that Congress can make a law.
No, Your Honor, I do not say that.
You do not say it?
No, I do not say that. No, sir. I say we stand. I'm sorry, Your Honor, if I
misunderstood both of you.
No, sir. I say we stand squarely and exclusively on the First Amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Glendon.